whilst mortgage broking is a game of numbers, and I do enjoy working with numbers, behind all those numbers, there's real people. So it's really the getting to know the people that that's important for me in terms of determining a finance strategy when I'm putting it together for people. So I try to look beyond the finance transaction and really get a good understanding of where people are coming from and what's led them to this point and what they're trying to get out of it. There's a lot of brokers in the industry that don't necessarily operate that way. They're in it for themselves mostly. But I try to look beyond that transaction and just and really look at what's possible over the course of a lifetime of working with the clients and what that's going to do for them.
Welcome to Get Invested on the Property Hub podcast channel, the leading weekly show to help you unlock your full self, health and wealth potential. I'm your host, Bushy Martin, and each week I go deep with the best investors, experts, leaders and founders to find out what it takes to break free from the grind, discover freedom and live by design. Subscribe now and join me and get invested in the life you really want. Let's get started.
Hi, Freedom Fighters. Who do you trust? And how do you decide on who you can trust? Now, these are important but often unasked questions, especially in property where you're trusting and relying on others to help you secure and grow your most expensive and valuable asset, which is your home or your investment portfolio. Because sustainable success in property is a game of finance and an elite team sport. And all of this revolves around trust. But for most of us, trust is not a conscious thought process, but more of an intuitive and intangible gut feel. Because as soon as we meet someone, we almost instinctively know whether we do or don't trust them. We just know. But why is that? Well, I find that trust is something that's really hard to define and quite difficult to put words around. We just know that when we meet someone, we immediately get a sense of whether we can trust them or we can't. And how often have you caught yourself overriding your initial distrusting gut feel for someone, only to find out the hard way later on that your gut was actually right from the get-go? Now, I've certainly made this mistake on many occasions in the past, but luckily, my life partner in all things Sonia, who is hands down the best intuitive reader of people that I've ever met, is a finely tuned BS detector that immediately defines the best from the rest, which invariably has actually kept me out of trouble. Now, it goes without saying that trust is mission critical to the success and sustainability of just about all of our relationships and interactions. But sadly, finding and experiencing real genuine trust is increasingly under threat. That's actually quite a rare commodity given the crisis of trust that we now experience in the world. You've just got to look at the daily barrage of fake news along with the constant shenanigans of politicians and priests who should know better and we actually expect a lot more from. Then there's the relentless stream of selfish, greed-driven antics of the banks and big business where profits generally come before people and everything just seems to be driven by short-sighted self-interest. A world where used car salespeople and real estate agents are now actually starting to look good compared to those that we expect to trust. We seem to live in a time where the catch cry is do what I say and show, not what I do, where the best story wins. An instant environment that's bereft of trust at a time of constant uncertainty when trust has never actually been more important to us. Consequently, it's now much harder to trust and find someone trustworthy than it's ever been. But to achieve anything in life, we need to trust others. It's the glue and building block that's at the heart of all of human civilization's great achievements, because together we continue to achieve much more. And all of this revolves and relies around trust. So how can we find those that we truly trust, and what is it that allows us to trust someone right from the outset? Now, as I said, this is hard to put into words, but for me, it's the quiet sense of humble confidence that the other person has, and then the feeling that they're genuine in what they say and do. And they say it how it is, not what I or others want to hear. It's about reliability and responsibility, about someone consistently doing what they say they're going to do and taking personal accountability for what they're doing without any excuses. It's about being open and vulnerable and admitting mistakes, because we all make them and none of us are perfect, but also demonstrating that we're what we're going to do to make up for any mistakes without pointing the fingers at others or blaming circumstances and situations. And trust is also about being upfront and having the quiet conviction to stick to your guns, even if this means disagreeing with you, because humble honesty and living your truth is actually the cornerstone of trust. It's about what you see is what you get, about someone who's quietly comfortable in their skin and doesn't need to impress you or anyone else. And at the individual connection level, mutual trust is about values alignment. Are you on the same page in relation to your core beliefs, outlooks, attitudes, and approaches? Because in the long term, this fundamental alignment is actually going to make or break the success of a relationship or situation. It's about finding your trust tribe and saying no to those that don't feel right, regardless of how good they might say they are or they might be, so that you can actually say yes to those that really matter and really care. Because we're all different, and as I keep saying, trust is a must. Now, nowhere is this more evident than on the sports field. Sustainably successful teams are those that intimately know, like, respect, and trust each other as they work towards common goals that are larger and more impactful than their own individual needs. Everyone knows what everyone else is going to do and what the overall game strategy is and how they all contribute to it because they trust, believe, and back each other. And the results, as a result, appear effortless and easy. Australia's current Test cricket teams are great examples of implicit trust in action. Conversely, teams that don't trust each other and start to rely on themselves as individuals experience a world of pain and failure. Now, the Wallabies' performance in last year's Rugby World Cup is a case in point, because at the end of the day, it's all about trust. Now, it's really similar in the home loan and mortgage world, where you're often at the mercy of quick and dirty low-rate loan banks or brokers who, like seagulls, often fly in, shot the lowest rate loan, and then fly out never to be seen again. So where and how do you find someone that you can trust that's going to be there beside you long-term through thick and thin to guide, protect, and grow your most expensive and biggest asset, being your home and your properties? Well, today, we're going to enjoy the company of someone who exemplifies all the elements of a trusted advisor and a whole lot more. Because when you finally meet someone that you immediately trust and feel comfortable and at ease with, and then that trust is amplified and reinforced consistently and reliably over time, you know that you're in great and very rare company, which is exactly how I felt and continue to feel about today's special guest, Laurie Moore. He's one of Know How Property's very own award-winning senior broker partners who consistently earns and builds the respect and trust of everyone he helps and works with over many years that we've been working together, and has helped many to safely secure their dream homes and property portfolios by maximizing their capacity while minimizing their costs and their risk. So today and next week, I thought we'd deep dive within on his own personal background and approach to help you to be better able to separate a trusted best broker from the rest so that you can better select a finance broker that has the ability to make instead of break your financial future. So welcome, and let's get invested, Laurie.
Thanks, Bushy. Thanks for having me on.
Mate, been looking forward to catching up with you for quite some time. I think your mortgage broker is best kept secret on many occasions, mate, because you have a very humble approach to life generally, but when you speak, everything you say is well and truly worth listening to, because it's always considered and always very sage advice. But for those that haven't had a chance to get to know you and understand what you bring to the table, Laurie, can you sort of start off by telling us about what you do differently and more importantly, I guess, why you do what you do?
No worries. Well, I guess I am a mortgage broker, I guess, is ostensibly a finance architect, as we call it in our business. But and whilst mortgage broker is a game of numbers, and I do enjoy working with numbers, behind all those numbers, there's real people. So it's really the getting to know the people that that's important for me in terms of determining a finance strategy when I'm putting it together for people. So I try to look beyond the finance transaction and really get a good understanding of where people are coming from and what's led them to this point and what they're trying to get out of it, really, at the end of the day, because everyone has a different story around that sort of thing. And sometimes that's an easy thing to do because people are quite open and trusting around that. But so sometimes you have to work on it a bit harder. But I think I'm, you know, I've got quite a friendly personality and pretty much able to talk to anyone. And I can explain things pretty well to people in a way that makes sense to them. And I think, you know, that's just about being open and honest and following up and doing, you know, all the stuff you said in your introductions, you know, doing the things that that I would expect if it was me talking to someone. You know, if someone says to me, "Oh, look, I'll get back to you tomorrow," well, I really expect they're going to get back to me tomorrow, right? So I always have that in my mind when I say something, I make sure that I follow up and do it, because without that, you know, you can't have that level of trust, can you? It just can't be there. So I try to do it differently, because I know there's a lot of brokers in the industry that don't necessarily operate that way. They're in it for themselves mostly. But I try to look beyond that transaction and just and really look at what's possible over the course of a lifetime of working with the clients, and what that's going to do for them, and what it's going to do for me, and what it's going to do for others that they might send my way as well. So I was looking like that. So I mean, I do this for that, but I also do it because I love the freedom of it. I have, you know, I've worked in corporate roles for a lot of my life, and really you were constrained by all of those all those policies and procedures and all that other crap that you have to put up with whilst you're stuck in a big corporate business. So working for myself and working with a know-how team just provides me with a great level of freedom that I really love. I do work hard, so don't get me wrong around that, but I'm able to split my time between working and other responsibilities that we all have, and that is one of the, you know, one of the top reasons why I love doing this job. But I do generally like helping people and helping to make those big decisions that change people's lives as well. And that could just be the first home buyer that comes through the door and has never bought a home before and needs a lot of guidance and hand holding through the process, or it could be the seasoned investor who you know, has a target in mind. And you're helping them to get there based on, you know, a different level of financial acumen and experience and knowledge, but you're working as a partner with them then to try and help them achieve what it is that what they want to do. So probably a lot in there, mate. But that's probably sums it up.
No, it's extremely well said, mate. And you know, I'm sort of nodding my head with everything you're saying there. And we both, you know, it come from corporate backgrounds in the past, and seen the opportunity that working in a small team environment where we're pretty much running our own business within the business, but collaborating with each other to be able to help others to achieve their goals. So I totally agree with you, mate, in relation to the satisfaction that brings. But I guess that sort of leads me to my next question, which is about sort of circling back a little bit and going back as far as you want to go, really, and talk us through. You know, where have you invested your time, energy, and money over the years, and why? And how has this actually led you to becoming a finance architect with know-how in the current arena?
Yeah, well, I always start by thanking my parents when someone asks me a question like that, because you know, without them, I wouldn't be here, right? but I don't know. I was brought up in Melbourne. I was born in Wantirna, out in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. So that takes us a fair way back. I was one of six kids. I was number four in the six. So pretty. I count myself in modern terms to be lucky to be here, because if it was, you know, a modern family, they would have stopped at number three for sure. I'd had two boys and then a girl, and I was next. So if they wanted to have a one for the country, and also have a mix of siblings in terms of boys and girls, then. Yeah, I still feel I'm pretty fortunate to be here from that point of view. So, but my dad was actually a bank manager, which is sort of how I started the finance stuff. So he was a bank manager in Melbourne, working for a lot of banks already, and he got a transfer up to Oya, which is up in the sticks of Victoria, not far from Mildura, an hour or so south of Mildura. Is about 1,600 people there. I spent 8 years of my schooling life there, and before he got a transfer back down to the Yarra Valley, actually out in Yarra Glen, and we spent another 4 years there where I finished off my school, and then he left the bank at that point. I mean, when I think about why he left, which I probably wasn't cognizant of at the time, but I think about why he left, he was under a great deal of stress and pressure, and was railing against the system really, and almost had a nervous breakdown as a result. But he escaped it, and he went and started up a a business down in Torbay, which was called Yummy Yogurt. It was a surfer's paradise. I came in and had all sorts of health foods and things like that. So he ran a successful business down there for quite some time. So he left me really. I was already working by then and working for one of the banks. So he left me to fend for myself. Really, it was too far to commute from Torbay, which is where he was, up to on the eastern suburbs of Melbourne. So that's sort of how I started.
Okay, so you went straight into the bank after leaving school, is what I picked up there.
I did, yes. Went straight into the bank and spent a good 4 years in my first role in retail banking, which I think, you know, I'd never go back and do retail banking now, but it was a great groundwork for learning about working life and dealing with customers and all of the problems that comes with, I guess, from that point of view, and working with people. And you know, in those days it was about processing checks and dealing with lots of cash. It's very different in a bank branch now. In fact, you walk in when they try and get you out of there as quick as they possibly can. Yeah, don't you in there at all. So it's one. Yeah, exactly. So, but that's what it was about back in those days. Showing my age a little bit there, but I worked in that field and did a few other roles as well until about 19 in the late 90s, I think, mate. And this is in the middle. I've done some overseas trips and all those sorts of things that you do when you're young. But that's when I met my wife Stephanie, who is actually from Adelaide through some mutual friends, and ended up moving over here 25 years ago now. So this is out here being Adelaide, that is. So I've lived here for 25 years now, and it was really only when I came here, I guess, I'm now sort of married, and we're married, Stephanie, and we've got two kids and a dog, so we're pretty much a normal suburban family from that point of view. A lot of time, energy, and money that goes into that is for sure. I'm coming out the other end of that god with a 21-year-old and a 19-year-old in my house. That's just getting them through university now, and then hopefully I will be on my way to being an empty nester. But whilst I was here, I worked through a couple of lending companies and doing management work and franchise work. And
so let me jump in there, because stepping out of the banks into the finance companies, that in itself is a reasonable step, because a lot of people don't even make that jump. But what was it that prompted you to go in a different direction from the banking career?
Well, look, I'd like to say it was planned, but it wasn't, Bushy. It's just that I came to Adelaide. And if you know Adelaide well enough, you know that it's a branch and not a head office. And so the corporate roles up to a certain point just don't exist in Adelaide in the bigger institutions. They're all in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane, some in Perth, depending on the bank that it is. So if I wanted to continue working at the bank and succeed, I really felt like, you know, being out of the big ones was the thing to do. And I got a job over here when I first came in a company, and that business worked closely with one of the big mortgage broking companies here in South Australia, Bertie Mills Homeland. And so you would have probably heard of Bertie's. Well, he was a stalwart of the industry and was it was one of the first brokers in South Australia, one of the first brokers in the country. And the business is still going. Bertie's no longer with us, unfortunately, but his son took over that, and then he subsequently handed on to someone else who's managing it. But it's still a big and growing concern here in South Australia. So I was working with them, and that's sort of where I got to know a bit about, it was my first taste of the mortgage broking industry. And I worked for another company that had franchising, and worked with brokers directly through our sort of mortgage management arm, which was sort of, you know, just mortgage lending, I guess, under a different guise. But that's where I got to meet a lot of mortgage brokers and work with a lot of mortgage brokers and work in and around them, that gave me a feel for what mortgage broking entailed and what was required and what worked and what didn't work.
So a transgression then from what you're doing there into actual broking. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, because it came about because one of the last companies I was working with, which was that franchise business, they sold the business. All the directors wanted to go their different ways, so they sold it to a larger publicly listed company out of Sydney. So we came from a branch of Sydney again, which is exactly what I was trying to avoid, right? So I stayed around for another 12 months or so, but in the end took a redundancy from there. And then I was at a stage where it was sort of like a midlife crisis to some degree. I'm going, well, okay, well, what do I know? What do I do? What do I do from here? And so I flailed around a little bit. I started up a small business with a mate of mine who also took a redundancy from the same company. We were actually importing furniture, can you believe it?
Wow, there's a change in direction.
Completely different thing, which we subsequently found out we knew nothing about. Right? So that's a learning curve for us. So we thought we did that, and I really enjoyed it actually, but it was going to be difficult to make any money out of it and try to work through the exchange rates and stuff. And you know, I did that. I worked for one of the document processing centres.
Yep.
Did a bit of work from there just on a casual basis, and I did a management role in the census back in, I think it was 2015 or 2016, something like that. So I was just sort of trying to feel it out, and I was figuring out whether mortgage broking was going to be what I wanted to do. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought how I thought it made sense. So I threw myself into it, and it was really only 12 months or so after that, pushing that we met.
Yeah.
And a long courting process with yourself and others in the team to work out, to make sure that we were a good fit together. So I've been doing it ever since. It's probably been about eight years or so in total since I've come back on the tools and been doing this. And as I said before, you know,
I love it. That's awesome, mate. Talk us about when you sort of look back, because you've had pretty broad experience when I look at it in various shapes and forms within the banking and finance industry. What are the sort of differences and benefits that you now see as being a senior broker partner with the know-how crew in a fairly close-knit team as to being part of a larger outfit or like many brokers are, one-person operations?
Yeah, well, it's I think the one-man band in mortgage broking is almost, well, they're not almost extinct, but they're becoming less relevant. It's a lot. Oh, there's still a few around, isn't there, Bona?
A lot. There's about 14,000 actually, Laurie.
It's incredible, really, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to pull all the levers of success in mortgage broking on your own, right? It used to be you just shuffle some papers around and away you went, but now you've got to be good at marketing, you've got to be good at branding, you've got to be at social media, you've got technology, relationship building, I don't know, credit, one off loan structuring, administration. There's still a lot of admin in this job, and there's an ever-increasing sort of compliance burden as well, and it just takes, you can't do it all yourself. That's what it comes down to. You're either doing a lot of work on your own at all hours of the day and night and weekends, etc., and not having much else of a life and kind of burn out at some point, yeah. Or you surround yourself with a team. The bigger teams, it's a bit like working for a lot of banks, isn't it? You're basically an extension of a corporate role, and people have their own interests at heart mostly. I mean, that's not always the case, and it does depend on the company, doesn't it?
But yeah.
The bigger company, is it's more likely that that's the case. So in a smaller, close-knit team like ours, where everybody has a similar outlook and you know, not just in it for themselves.
Yeah.
We're run to succeed I don't know, and from there share successes. I think it's a perfect size and a perfect fit from my point of view to be working in a team.
Yeah, likewise, mate. Again, I'm biased, obviously, but I just think we've got with yourself and the rest of the crew, we've just got a very rare team that we do some great work and we have a lot of fun. So I love that, mate.
I was just going to say, Bush, it just gives an opportunity to share all those hats around too, doesn't it? You know, all that fluff. All that stuff that you got to do with an individual broker, if you haven't got a team around you, we're all good at different parts of our jobs. So it does allow me to focus on the parts that I'm good at, because I know that others in the team are looking after the parts that I've inherited good stuff up.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think, you know, as you've said, the amount of compliance work that's now involved in the process from end to end, in the years that I've been in the game, I've just seen it grow exponentially almost. Someone's trying to do all that as well as meet clients and come up with the right solutions and talk to the banks, and they wouldn't sleep. Impossible to do that properly. But as you've said, you know, having the right people in the right parts of the process to manage all of that and allow you to spend your high-value team on the loan strategy and structuring, which is, you know, what you're very good at, works for everyone, mate. So, now I really appreciate that. I guess sort of taking a big step back now, mate. If you look back on your journey so far, and you look at both professionally and personally, what challenging event in your life has brought about your greatest learnings and your best changes, do you think?
Well, I probably think it's probably that redundancy I mentioned, Bushy. You know, that was back in 2015, so it was really before I jumped into the mortgage broking on the tools per se, without sort of that helicopter sort of view that I've had before. So for me, it was because I was feeling a bit obsolete at that time. You know, I'd gone through quite a number of decades of working in the finance industry, and I'd worked hard and I'd done a lot of study and done a lot of qualifications and done all that sort of stuff. But I just sort of thought, well, what have I, you know, where has it got me to now? I'm in my early to mid 40s, and I'm thinking, what's next as far as my career is concerned? So I was quite fearful around that. I was used to a regular pay packet, so that the working as a self-employed person was real thing I had to overcome if I was going to take up mortgage broking and be self-employed, because that's pretty much how you're remunerated.
Yeah.
I was uncertain, feeling a bit obsolete, a bit fearful around that, and you know, my lesson from that is that self-employed is a blessing, really, in the freedom that it provides. It's just that ability to manage your own time, get rewards for your own efforts, and work with like-minded people. It increases the amount of effort that you put in increases tenfold in self-employment versus what you would get from a corporate work experience. That's been my experience of it. It's been so rewarding, mate. And like, you know, there's that sense of identity and the financial aspect's been good as well. But that's just been not something I've focused on. It's just been more on focusing on doing the best job that I can possibly do. And
which you certainly do. And I think you make a good point. There's often. And I had this myself before I jumped into the world of self-employment. That weekly paid packet becomes a bit of a golden handcuffs to some degree, and you feel like you're jumping off the cliff and sort of trying to build some wings on the way down. But I think looking back on it now, once you get over that initial period, that first couple of years, there's probably more security in self-employment than there is in a job these days, because you can be on a good income today and gone tomorrow with the way the corporate world works, versus effectively running our own business. We've got much more hands-on control over what that income looks like and what we can do about it. So it's not many people have the confidence and the courage to take that step. A lot get to the edge and then step back. So I love the fact that you had the self-confidence to do that, and you've certainly flourished since then, mate. We've really enjoyed seeing your confidence and your results blossom as you continue to work in the industry. But I guess, you know, everything we do revolves around money to some degree. And let's face it, money is the oil that lubricates everyone's lifestyle these days. So what does money mean to you, mate? And as an extension to that, what have you personally invested your money in, when and why?
Yeah, well, obviously, money's pretty important, mate. It makes the world go around, as they say. You can't. It's hard to do much without it. Or there's a limitation to what you can do if you don't have much of it. And that's, you know, become more and more evident over the last 12 to 18 months, hasn't it? Whilst interest rates have been increasing so much and cost of living's gone up and everyone's feeling the pinch around that. I don't know how many conversations a day I would have about that with either friends or family or clients. So the first thing I did in terms of money is, I really early in my life I wanted to do some travel. So it was about putting some money aside from that point of view. Yeah, before we settled down and do all that sort of stuff, I certainly made sure that I had some time to do that. I think probably one of the Things that I didn't do in that early, in those early stages was take enough risk with money though. You know, I was very much driven by what my dad had told me, and, you know, Auntie June and all those sorts of people had told me what to do with your money. And that was mostly keeping you in the bank, earning 2 pounds of stuff all on interest, right? I figured it out eventually and got into ETFs and started investing regularly in that way to build up a bit of a nest egg to do something with. That was travel for a while, and it became property after that, I guess. But I did build up quite a sizable share portfolio as well, which, you know, became a bit of a second job in lots of ways because, I really was doing all the research myself. I was buying and selling myself and taking time and never quite sure whether you're making the right decision. I guess you can't really be, but I was also buying small tranches of things which probably were never going to amount to much, and so more research was definitely required. So it took me a while, but I eventually engaged a professional to take that over for me, and it was a massive relief in that respect. So the share portfolios has grown and builds over time, and that's been fantastic. After we got married, we bought our first home, and we're still in that house, funnily enough, after all these years. But we've spent a lot of money on the house. We invested a lot of money in the house, and that's just to be about raising a family in a house, right? That first house was not. I look at what it was now. I thought, well, would I have bought it if I know what I know now? Probably not. We've spent a lot of money on it. To get it to a point, but you know, it's been a great investment in context of the equity position that we now find ourselves in, and that happens over time more than anything. It's more luck than anything else from that point of view. So I've leveraged out of that and built a couple of houses over time as well in terms of investment properties, which has been fantastic from the point of view of depreciation and negative gearing of those properties, and writing them down across time. So I guess my money's gone back to that, but I'm sort of at a stage now where I'm trying to make the most of self-managed super and build up an nest egg for eventual retirement. I'm probably, I don't know how many years, but at least five around that sort of time frame, maybe a bit longer. Just depends how long I'm enjoying it for. I'm still loving it that much. So you just don't worry. Certainly our focus down the track is to do some travels, some more travel locally and internationally as well. So work towards that aspect and being financially free enough to be able to do it, which was still a few years away from my perspective.
Yeah. No, I love that, mate. I appreciate you sharing that. I'm going to sort of test your memory a bit now, because one of the things that we both find with the people that we are working with, particularly first time investors, is actually, you know, as I often say, it's a start that stops most people, because it's making that first step that's often the hardest and the biggest one. And if you think back to when you first started investing, can you remember what your initial fears were or any feelings of concern about investing? And can you share how you overcame them to actually take the leap?
Well, I think it's probably, if you're talking about, if you're thinking about a property investment, it's that upfront cost, isn't it? It can be quite daunting. You think, well, how am I going to come up with that 10% deposit and, you know, the stamp duties and all the purchase costs associated with that? So that can be quite a daunting thing. And also, borrowing that money and being responsible for the repayments and thinking about what those repayments are now and what they might be in the future and how long it's going to take you to pay the bloody thing back. It feels like it'll never happen, right? I'm never going to get to the end of this. And then it was like you've got a growing family and you've got an impact on your cash flow at the time because, yeah, maybe your wife or yourself isn't working as much, and looking after kids, you've got increased costs with childcare. All of those things sort of are bounding around and that can tie you down and leave you in sort of like a decision paralysis sort of time. But count it, I think you've just got to be able to look beyond that. I think it's some care from budgeting and getting some buffers in place. I think, you know, we always talk about that in this business, especially people that are investing. You know, you've got to have a buffer. If you're investing in property, you can't be just relying on your cash flow, because if something goes wrong unexpectedly, then it's it's got to be difficult to hold the property. And we both know that a lot of people invest in one property, and that's as far as they go because they haven't thought about these things up front. So I think, like, from my point of view, that whilst, you know, I've learned a lot whilst I've been in the business and working with you personally and in terms of how to best do that, you know, what the gold class process is, it's certainly something that I adopted early on. I wasn't going to take too much risk from that point of view and make sure that I'd spent my last dollar trying to establish myself in property and didn't overstretch myself as far as borrowing is concerned. So there was always a bit of a buffer in there to ride through those times when things became, you know, tighter as far as cash flow is concerned or heavier as far as spending is concerned.
Yeah, extremely well said, mate. The other thing I like to dig into here is to sort of get a sense of people's investment strategies. And I'd love for you to share, you know, what was your investment strategy when you first started, if you had one? How has this changed and evolved over time and why, if you can share that with us?
Yeah, I think initially I just wanted to build a nest egg, right? So I wasn't sure what I wanted to use it for. At that time, I was still a single young fella having a good time, but I didn't want to, you know, certainly didn't want to spend more than I earned. So I was, you know, quite good from a budgeting point of view and putting money aside. And I think I reckon that's a little difficult these days because nowadays you hardly use cash. Pretty much no one uses cash, and that's. So it's a lot more difficult to manage. You just pay wave everything and chin, chin, chink, it comes out of your bank account. And the number of transactions that are on there, you lose track all by the time. So I think having a system and a process in place for that now is even more important than it was then. For me, it was making sure that I had a set aside an amount that I was able to spend, and then I would have other aspects that were there to meet expenses, and then there were other part that was there. It was savings or whatever I chose that to be at the time. And that, you know, to be honest, that changed over time. It was holidays and it was houses and it was investment properties and it was shares and it was all sorts of things. So it was really, for me, it was just about starting off and doing that right. And I'm trying to embed that in my young adults, in my household at the moment, which is pretty difficult at this point. But I'm nothing but resilient, and I will try. I'll try and bend that in. Yeah, I'll tell you a story about that, actually, Bushy, if you don't mind me saying this. But I remember going away as a family when my kids were probably about 10 and 8, and they were just getting pocket money at the time, and you know, knew that we were going up to Queensland to do the trip up in Queensland, go to the Gold Coast and go to the various worlds and things. And I said, you've got to save your pocket money towards this. So I built a Gantt chart, you know, one of those charts over time. And I said, okay, so here you go. You're getting, I can't remember the figures now, but it would have been $5 or $10 of pocket money a week. And you can't spend it all because they get it and they want to spend it. So I was like, okay, well, let's put a little bit aside. And then I built a graph over time to show them what would happen when we started out at zero. And I said, if you can get to $50, if you can save your $50, I'll give you another $50. That would be your bonus when you get there. So every week we drew out the chart and we drew the line and we showed the progression as we got to the target weight. So that's the first thing I did to try and get them to do it. And then, yeah, I've tried a few other things over time, but I've still got some work to do there, I think. Anyway, I've digressed away from your question.
No, I think that stuff is really key because those habits that we develop early on, once they're baked in, they're pretty fundamental. And I think, as you mentioned, in this day and age, Laurie, there's so many distractions out there. Constantly 24/7, yes. And so much noise that if those habits aren't started early, that there's no chance of them happening. It's so easy because money's not physical anymore. Like you said, there's very little cash around these days, and checks don't exist. In fact, we're getting to the point where you're going to have to pay to get cash out of the bank, which is not far away. Then that intangibility and the tap, tap, tap exercise where you just don't really get a sense of its value, it's actually going to be more challenging, I think. So I think that what you've done there and visually adding to the reward system to get them into that is a fundamental, but should be taught in schools, mate. You get alone at home. But love you sharing that, mate. I guess before we get off the investment and money topic for now, if we look back on again your journey overall, what would you say has been both your best and your worst investment, and what have you learned from each of those?
Well, with my worst, I'm tempted to say crypto, Bushy, but because I did jump in a little bit there, doing a bit of gambling, I think, is how I would describe it. It's made a bit of a comeback of late, so in general, the gambling's sort of paying off a little bit. Although it's just a little bit of fun. It's not money that I would I wouldn't put my fortune in there and hope for the best. Put it that way. So just didn't want to miss out on the wave. My worst investment was definitely term deposits, mate. They just did nothing for me, right? So I really would not. I mean, I'm starting out back now with my son finishing uni this year, and I won't be putting his money in the bank. We even got him into something you know, you probably know this system is called Raise, right?
Yep.
So there's a couple of similar platforms like that where you can get in there and there's a direct, you know, like an ETF, I guess, but it's a share.
Cover
fund, and you're investing in the share market and getting a return and getting a feel for it and getting some excitement around it rather than being fleeced by a bank. We'll talk about that more in stage two, I imagine. But
yes, absolutely.
So for me, I look at that as guys, it was low interest, and that was nowhere near enough risk for a young man, really. I should have been taking a bit more risk with my money than that. I mean, yes, you don't want to lose your capital, but you can afford to take a bit more risk when you're young. But on the best side, it's certainly been around the house and buying a first home. Good properties in good locations, always rising value. And there's been tax benefits for me in terms of building a couple of investment properties as well, which has been awesome. So those properties have been fantastic. But equally, shares have been good for me too.
Yeah.
So I did okay until I did a lot better when I engaged an expert to help me. I was spending, as I said before, I was spending a lot of time doing trading and trying to figure out who we invest in next, and doing lots of small transactions, and you know that made a massive difference when I got someone in who actually knew what they were doing. And I think the thing that I didn't do enough of that I wish I'd done more of now, is leverage.
Yeah,
leverage more. Really, I could have done more of that, and I would have been in a much better position if I'd not taken that on early. And also easy with the benefit of hindsight. But the opportunity was there to do it. I did do some, but I was a bit risk averse, I guess, in that respect, and didn't do as much as what I did. And that's for all of the reasons that I mentioned before, you know, around changing in household circumstances, kids coming along, costs increasing, all of that sort of stuff, which made me hesitant to not take a bit more risk around it. But, you know, I didn't do it. I can't really change it now, but I still don't care out of time invested as much as I thought I was comfortable with at the time. And, you know, we talk about this with clients, don't we? It's everybody's story is different around that, and what you're comfortable with and what someone else is comfortable with is always going to be different. There's always going to be differences around that. And there's no right answer. So you do.
No, there isn't. And that sleep at night factor is an absolute key. And you know, if I look at, you know, where you've come from the family, from what I'm picking up is, you know, with father and mother who, given the banking background, would have been very conservative in their... that would have been more savers than investors.
I think they were saving much because they had six kids, man.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true, mate, actually. Yeah, half a cricket
session. I still remember going shopping with them and filling up two trolleys.
Yeah, I love it.
All the fancy packaging that we had now, you know, it was just... full of meat and veggies, I think. So, well, I can't imagine what that grocery bill would be like now.
Horrendous. Horrendous now. And then, as you know, my good wife, Sonia, she's one of 12 mates. So no wonder her father ended up buying a supermarket and had their own chicken farm. I'm not surprised.
Yeah, so, profits were down, though, I think. I'd have to say, because
that's right.
I'm not
only use. jumping into the future then, mate. Everyone who comes on, as you know, I talk a lot about living by design and living with intent. Can you paint us a bit of a picture of your life vision, your ideal lifestyle, and what you're continuing to invest in to make that happen?
Well, we're trying to work towards that financial independence now, which I guess for me it means about that freedom to travel, like I was talking about earlier. Now, we sort of started doing it to some degree, but mixed in with work. And that's the beauty of working in this job, in this industry, is you can work from anywhere, right? I can work from a coffee shop. I could almost work from a cruise ship if I had some internet there.
Good idea. I'm under that.
I might be otherwise distracted if that was the case. I'd certainly need to get something other than a cabin with a nice deck or something like that. But I don't know, you probably can't get internet on those things. I've never tested it, so I don't know. But you can work from anywhere. So I have started doing a little bit of this, but it's definitely my dream from here is to work less and travel more. And also invest in supporting in the family, really. So I've got to the point where they're at uni and they're going through various life's stage events. You know, I just had my son's 21st at home scarily recently, and that was a big event. So like another one of those to come, and then invariably, you know, engagement parties, weddings, whatever happens around that, you just don't want to have the time when you're that sort of stuff. But yeah, there's buying houses, and hopefully they've got somebody in the family who can help them with that and getting set up in life, I guess. Yeah. Myself go through those. And then the other thing for me, it's about, you know, remaining healthy, and remaining active and remaining healthy. It's always been a cornerstone for me. I remember being at a conference in one of those corporate roles I was talking about years ago, and one of the speakers got up and he said, okay, I want you all to think about your top four things that are the most important to you in your life at the moment. So I gave everyone a few minutes to think about that, and he said, okay, who's got health in there? And about maybe 10% of the audience put their hands up, and he goes, well, by the looks of you, health, if it isn't one of your top four at the moment, it will be very soon. So you should change your focus around that. So it's always stuck with me. It's, you know, probably didn't tell a story in the greatest way, but for me, keeping active and remaining healthy is important, because you can't enjoy life without, right?
Absolutely.
It's a big thing for me. And then, you know, so apart from traveling and that social interaction through family and keeping fit, this really just keep creating new connections as well. I've recently gone back to started playing some tennis with some guys. I went through a lot of years of following my son around late playing with his little sporting pursuits, but now that he's old enough, he can go and do that himself. So I'm back into it myself. So I've been playing some tennis and I've met some really great people through that as well. So that's sort of where I want to start getting that financial independence. I think that's probably 5 years away from me now, where I can really decide that I want to take a step back, if that's indeed what I decide to do at the time. And that'll probably depend on how much travel and what other things are happening around that time in terms of some of those milestones that I mentioned.
Yeah, and I love that, mate. I guess if we sort of bring that all to a head now, and sort of reflecting back, and you've touched on a little bit of this already, yep. But if you're starting out again now, Laurie, what, if anything, would you invest in differently? And I'm not talking about money investment, but investing in knowledge, skills, experience, etc. Is that anything that you'd do differently?
Well, I probably would have continued my schooling. I left schooling in year 11.
Yeah.
Well, I went straight into a bank. I really wanted to get out of the school environment. I wasn't very happy there, so I decided to leave. And so I would have continued doing more of that, but I realised that I'd made a mistake by the time I was in my mid-20s. So I actually went back to uni and did a degree part-time and finished that. It took me 5 years to do that. And after a three-year or so break, I did a master's as well, yeah, which was master's of business. So I ended up catching up on my study, but I really should have got that done a lot earlier, I think. There were other priorities for me at the time. So I think just starting a bit younger around that, also starting a bit younger around investing in property. I was 30 by the time I started that, which doesn't sound that old, but that was for my first owner-occupied home, and then gearing up from there. But I think there are more opportunities around that as well that I could have taken advantage of. And as I said before, I think leveraging more and taking a bit more risk, I think that's something that I definitely regret not having done now that I've reached my current situation. So, that's where it was at the time, as I said. So happy to do it. But I think you start as young as you can, get the right advice. Yeah, as I said, shares. I went around with that myself for a long time, and really, I probably done better out of that as well too, if I engaged the right people and the right experts. And I think when I come down to what this business is about, that's exactly what we're here for, right? We're all here to help people to not make the same mistakes we've made in the past. So, and let's get them to their own version of financial independence. So I really encourage people to talk to Bushy and the team and get involved.
Yeah, extremely well said, mate. I think the keys with what you're sharing, let's look at the education piece. You wouldn't have been ready to do anything any younger anyway. And I think from my perspective, when you decided to take that education, you really wanted to that education. So you've got to be more interested, more committed to seeing that through than feeling like you had to, because that's what mum and dad said. So, I think you picked up what you needed at the appropriate time. On the investment front, while it's always easy to say, well, I should have leveraged more, but you also done a lot over that time. There's not many that would have dived into the equities arena to level you did. And again, by doing it yourself, you really intimately got to understand how it worked before you're in a position then to have some confidence to hand it over to someone that's what they do full time, and they might get more optimal, more results. But you've invested enough energy in understanding that to be able to manage them, to know that the results they're getting are the ones that you're hoping to get. So all good on that front. But I guess it wouldn't be right if we didn't finish this conversation by talking about our mutual interest in the mighty Richmond Tigers. Because that was, as I've said to you a number of times, that was the ceiling deal. You're a 99.9% on board with us, but that was the icing on the cake as far as the Tigers go, mate. And a lot of people listening to this were going, oh, I'm grown.
There he goes again on this Tigers bet. Yeah, here we go. Well, look, I'm a bit of a tragic again. I followed my dad into that. Now my son's followed me into it, and it's been... Yeah, well, it was been very painful 30 years up until the last buy. It's very bit of a successful era. And, I took my son to the 20, no, I didn't, we didn't go to the 2017 grand final. The 2017 grand final, my son was 14. And that was the same age I was when Richmond previously won a premiership. Yeah. Fucking got to see another two after that. So, yeah, we'll probably bore people if we talk about the Tigers for too long. But
good stuff, mate. Look, really enjoyed sharing the journey so far, mate. I really want to thank you for taking the time to share the ins and outs. And before we sort of close off on part one, if anyone would actually like to ask any further questions or leave comments about what we've talked about today, I encourage you all to join and jump onto the Property Hub Collective interactive Facebook community. Just click on the link in the show notes and we can keep the conversation going with other like-minded, hardworking Aussies that are looking to improve their knowledge and expertise in that area. So, mate, I really now look forward to continuing the conversation in part two, where we're really going to dive into the property loan side of the equation and the whole world of borrowing, and in terms of helping others to actually get the best loan solution to suit them. So, thanks again for joining us, Laurie, and we'll look forward to talking to you then.
Thanks, Fuji. Really appreciate it, mate.
Stay tuned for part two of this interview next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to Get Invested on the Property Hub podcast channel, your home for property investment insights and inspiration. And don't leave yet until you've taken the next step towards living by design. By getting my award-winning book, Get Invested, absolutely free when you sign up at knowhowproperty.com.au or bushymartin.com.au. And finally, make sure you subscribe to Property Hub to get your weekly dose of Get Invested inspiration, along with every episode of Realty Talk, Australia's leading property show for red-hot property investing news and insights, direct from industry leaders and influencers. Remember to always get invested in your knowledge, and I look forward to seeing you next time.